T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
The big picture from an introspective, philosophical LeBron James as he nurses his injured hand, we learn of after the fact, as the Cleveland Cavaliers roll over to expose their soft white underbelly to finally be eviscerated by their foe, the champion Golden State Warriors. Here to talk about that and what ensues is Mark Deeks, our favorite NBA expert from England, at least, if we need a qualifier there. He's a Give Me Sport, NBA UK, at Mark Deeks, NBA. Mark, hello. Good evening to you.
Good morning, good afternoon, good wherever we're at, time-wise. Pleasure to be here, regardless.
What do you think is the significance of finding out, as we did, about James's injury, both what it says about his performance after it occurred and the fact that this incredibly disciplined competitor wasn't such when it came to a fit of pique?
Well, it seems very plausible that, in hindsight, that it did affect his performance. After the heroics of Game 1, where he did a bit of everything, he didn't do that in Games 2, 3, and 4. Most notably, he stopped looking to take jumpers, and he missed a bunch of layups that isn't a very LeBron James-like thing to do. I mean, he wasn't exactly struggling. He still put up near triple-doubles and had that amazing self-alley-oop, but he wasn't doing quite as much as he exhibited in Game 1 and all throughout the Celtics series. So the story does check out that it notably affected him. As for the injury itself, I mean, it's hard to pass any kind of comment on it without sounding haughty. We all lose our temper, gentlemen, do we not? Especially with regards to work and sometimes even with colleagues. You may chew each other out. I don't know, that's your own business, but we all do it. And normally, we all get away with it. LeBron didn't. Now, I guess it is considered a moment of weakness, and it was certainly a moment that punished his team because he wasn't able to do as much as he needed to do to overcome the massive disadvantages they were faced. But what does it say about him? I don't know, that he cares, that we know, that he's human after all. It didn't swing the series. They were losing either way. And if he gets frustrated knowing the best chance that his team had was that Game 1, that they blew through errors, most notably but not exclusively that of J.R. Smith at the end there, well, I mean, we can understand where it comes from, no?
Hearing that LeBron busted his hand, as I did over the weekend, and then thinking about, as you said, something that makes him just like us, makes him human, makes him accessible, makes him flawed, I guess. It's amazing that LeBron is where he is in the pantheon of athletes, and yet even this, a thing that would make him accessible to those who would otherwise denigrate the career or put him behind Jordan, even being human, nobody gives a damn. And everyone's going to move on and just deride him for this like they will whatever decision he ends up making this offseason. I wonder, you know, if there's anything he does over his next X amount of years in the NBA that changes anyone's opinion who's already solidified one about him and against him.
Well, we have that control ourselves as individuals. If you want to think less of LeBron for anything LeBron does, you can choose to. I would encourage anybody who thinks less of him for this or any isolated incident of humanity to consider why they're doing that. But to each his own, whatever criteria you want to judge success by, go for your life. Like you say, it makes him accessible. It makes him human. I don't think those are bad qualities. I think the fact that he punched, a blackboard and broke his hand, whereas his great rival in this all-time historic debate, Michael Jordan, used to occasionally punch his teammates. Perhaps we could read something into that if we wanted to. Nevertheless, we all have the choice of how much we choose to value this. I personally am choosing it to give it absolutely no value whatsoever when we look back at his legacy. If you want to talk about the fact that he's 3-6 in NBA finals, okay, that's not something you can say about his peers, but then we have to get into a debate about how much of that is his fault. He was no way he was going to win this year, even with 3 good hands. So he wasn't going to win when he was paired with Larry Hughes and Zydrunas Ilgauskas back when they got swept by the Spurs. Context is everything. And if you want to take a negative position against LeBron James in assessment of his legacy, you may, but why?
Sports gambling is legal where Mark Deeks is at the moment. It is increasingly legal here in the United States. And I'm looking at the initial Vegas odds to win the next NBA championship. And all I can think of is how somebody might be trying to game this by wondering where or betting where LeBron James may go and finding a value pick. And I do this only for conversation's sake, but look, the Chicago Bulls are in a group on the very far outside at 500-1. Maybe somebody takes $20 and says, you know what, if LeBron James decides on a whim he wants to play for the Bulls and here's their pitch, so you know what, I'm going to do this. And that would be an interesting call from a gambling perspective, which is not, you know, I'm not real good at understanding the gambler's perspective, but in the case of somebody like LeBron James, I don't know how you're setting odds now in the NBA without thinking about these possibilities, Mark.
I mean, if you want to spend $20 on the Bulls signing LeBron, again, you have that right. You have your individual free will and determinism. I would advise you, however, to probably just spend that on like a nice lunch or something. That's not going to happen. No one can know the situation because LeBron doesn't know the situation right now. All he can really know at this point is what the main criteria are for him to decide his future. You just included the soundbite there of him talking about his family, having a young family. These are the humanizing things that we don't think about that do play a legitimate role in his decision. All he can do at this point is know what is most important to him, and thereafter, when the phones start ringing on July the 1st, he can make his decision. I'm not going to pretend that these conversations do not happen before July the 1st. They do, but not with the transparency and full volume of detail that is needed to make such an important decision for his welfare. Now, personally, I still believe he's going back to Cleveland. That may put me in the minority, but I do believe that. I'm not saying he should. I'm saying I think he will. But whatever criteria I or any of us choose to assign to his decision as to what we think he should decide based upon doesn't really matter. It's all about what he wants. And like we said before, last time I was on, wherever he goes, he's going to become a contender. So I won't worry too much about that part. He would make Chicago amongst the very best, if not the very best, in the Eastern Conference next year, and that's despite the fact that Chicago will come on off a tough season. So I won't worry too much about where he'll go to be competitive. He'll be competitive regardless as long as he stays in the East.
Mark, a lot of people are wondering whether or not the Eastern or Western conferences should call more to him. Team specifics are obviously going to be a lot of things, and the Houston Rockets are one thing versus going, you know, to the Kings or something. I don't know. I just picked the Kings. If you were tasked to sell the West as a conference, as a destination to LeBron, how would you go about building your case to potentially face the Warriors, I guess, before the NBA Finals?
Oh, Lord. Well, to be the best, you've got to beat the best regardless of which conference you're in. So perhaps in that respect, you can sell the fact that you've got to go through the Warriors regardless. Mm-hmm. Let's now sell you on the basis of our merits as an individual team. Good luck doing that as Sacramento. But like you said, you chose them at random. Can't see it happening, but you never know. Your luck. The Eastern Conference is not going to be as open next year as it has been this year. Cleveland were not the best team in the Eastern Conference this year. They were essentially the luckiest, at least at the end. Boston was the best team in the Eastern Conference this year, and injury is what shut them out. Perhaps a little bit of inexperience, but injury is what swung that series and one monumental Game 7 shooting slump. They got some incredible... They got Hayward and Irving coming back even before they upgrade their team, which I'm sure they'll do over the summer. This is not Cleveland's East, even though they've won it 4 years in a row. It wasn't their East this year. It arguably wasn't their East last year either. So the West is a harder conference, certainly, but Cleveland were not the best team in the East. They were the luckiest. You could say the same, I suppose, about Golden State. They were the luckiest. Chris Paul's injury, they would not have made this finals. It was two lucky Game 7s for these two. Nonetheless, although the East is not going to be as winnable as it has been with Boston and Philadelphia, let's not forget, on the come up, It's still going to be a bit easier than going through Golden State and the Houston Rockets and anyone else who may wish to join them. So good luck to any Western team being able to take a career Eastern Conference player and a career NBA Finals mainstay and getting him out West when East is probably easier for him to achieve his ambitions.
So let's use that as context for talking about the Bulls and where they are right now. There's been a couple of news notes regarding the Bulls since we last talked. Now, we know they have the number 7 pick. There have been some trying to connect them to Trae Young, but it's that time of year when you half believe, if that, anything you hear regarding the draft and who teams are looking at. We read in the Sun Times this morning that the Bulls are unhappy with Chris Dunn's offseason work and and worry that maybe he's getting a bit complacent over his starting position. Again, that also could be pre-draft smoke. Adrian Wojnarowski of ESPN believes the Bulls could be what he called sneaky in free agency, mentioning Clint Capela. Others have said Jabari Parker could be a target. Maybe try some of these restricted guys first and make an early splash. Is anything changing, or do you think it's smart for the Bulls to accelerate a rebuild, or is all this just idle talk?
Well, the cap space excess that we've seen in the last few years is no longer the case. There was a time in the not-too-distant past, I believe 18 teams had cap space in the same offseason because of the massive salary cap spike and the fact that incumbent contracts took a while to grow as well. So whereas once they were one of many, now they're back to a situation where they're one of a few, which is how cap space used to be. That does entitle them to be somewhat picky, yes. It also empowers them, if they want, to be aggressive, knowing that many others can't. Capela is a great example. If Houston has these ideals of getting LeBron or someone comparable, Paul George, then Capella's situation becomes difficult. They can't trade him. They can only sign and trade him, which is not nearly as feasible as it used to be. And whatever contracts, offer sheet, that Capela signs takes up Houston's cap accordingly. So he's very available if Houston really does have designs on getting in that third, let's say fourth star, depending on your opinion of Capela himself. If they really wanted Capela, I'm sure it's possible. Jabari, don't go there. Capela, yes, could do it. So shoot your shot. If you assume there's no hope, you guarantee there's no hope, regardless of whether or not we believe that Chicago should have gone down the road they've gone down, and the inefficiency of some of the decisions that have taken them down this route. The fact is, a direction was drawn up at this time last year, and progress was made through Dunn, through Markkanen, even through David Nwaba and a couple of other pieces that were picked up during the year. Bobby Portis looking good. The Bulls will now reload without, it seems, ever picking at the very top of the draft due to accidentally being a little too good for part of this season, which in a sense is a bit irksome, but is also the best reason to not pick at the top of the draft. They were accidentally too good. All of the players on that team, with bar a couple of exceptions, are either young players with plenty of talent who could be a part of the future, or very tradable veterans who also serve a role in the interim. It's not a bad position to be in at all, and they've still got assets, even if it's not as many as it could have been. So if they want to accelerate it and go out and get somebody like Capela whilst they have most of their assets in play, I totally get that. The dream of them picking 1-2-3 is not going to happen. Let's not worry about that now. Let's look at what they can get. They can come out this summer with an Eastern Conference playoff team, a young Eastern Conference playoff team with internal growth potential.
How do you grade out Clint Capela and the advancements his game has made? I mean, if he moves away from Houston in that situation where all he just rolled to the bucket and become that JaVale McGee sort of thing in that we saw during the playoffs, how does he work away from that super team?
Well, I liken it to Tyson Chandler. Who at the end of his time in Chicago didn't look very good. He had some health troubles. He might not have been in the best shape. He lost his confidence for whatever reason. And it got to the point that offensively, all he did was commit moving screens. But then he got to New Orleans, and Chris Paul made him look good. He was rolling to the rim. He was catching lobs. He started hitting his foul shots. He had the same sort of physical package and limited skill set, and yet he was turning into a double-figure scorer and someone you cannot neglect on the roll. He did that because of a great point guard. Now, it's not a coincidence that Capela has Paul and James Harden are constantly finding open for wide-open dunks. It's not a coincidence that he can't really make a shot outside of 3 foot and that he's a bad foul shooter. He's a very comparable player to Tyson Chandler in a very comparable situation. So it's a legit concern to say that if Capela leaves that situation, he will stop looking as good. But two things to consider here. A, the fact that he's a good rebounder and defender will translate, or at least it will do within a good and well-coached system. And B, the fact that he is that kind of player gives him an opportunity for the Bulls' guards to look better. Robin Lopez, good as he is not that type of player. He's not above the rim. He's not the dynamic role man. He's not the constant option every time a guard can penetrate the first line of the defense over the top. So if they get Capela or somebody like him, Chris Dunn, who I'm not going to touch the whole not working hard enough thing. What he's doing right now, he's shining defensively. He's still trying to find his role offensively. Give him an excellent role man like Capela, he's going to start looking a bit better. The floor is going to start being spaced better, which sounds perverse when we're talking about a player who absolutely cannot shoot from outside the paint. But because you can't leave off him because the lob's always there, the corners open up, the spacing gets better. Capela as an individual might not look as good once he's taken away from these elite players in Paul and Harden. but he will become a key piece who can grow alongside those who may go on to achieve at least some of the stardom that they have now.
Why did you dismiss Jabari Parker out of hand?
Because it's, the cost-benefit analysis is not favorable to him. If you can get him filthy cheap, okay, fine. But he really, 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 really cannot defend, and it's trending the wrong way. And there's a lot of injury history. So if you can get him for MLE money, good luck to you, but I don't think you can.
Mark, it's great, and I know we're going to have – we already just got some news. Apparently, Dwayne Casey, according to Woj, Dwayne Casey, a five-year deal to coach the Detroit Pistons. Oh. So it's not much of a move for him, and he's going to stay in the same regional area. The coach of the year who got fired is now going to have a job. Does that make the Pistons any better?
Yeah, that's the right move, and they still need a lot of work on that roster, and good luck making Blake fit. But what they've done thus far, anyway, is the right move. Casey has adapted over the course of the last year to the NBA's new style of play. That Raptors team was good. They got in their own heads. They seem to fear LeBron. Perhaps Casey can take some culpability for why they knocked out in the playoffs. But the regular season was a damn fine one. So, yeah, that's the right move.
All right, Mark, look forward to talking with you again soon. Have a great rest of your evening.
And yourself. Thank you.
That is Mark Deeks. He's got some great videos out there at NBA UK and Give Me Sport. He is a must-follow on Twitter if you're an NBA fan, at Mark Deeks, DeeksNBA.
They walk you through the game.
Yeah.
They walk you through situations in the game. He is the reason I was able to, you know, kind of figure out the whole Clint Capella thing and why I asked him about him in the first place. I know, as and he mentioned it, as a restricted free agent, Houston's got its hands tied a little bit when it comes to Capella if they're going to go ahead and add, whether it's George or LeBron, something like that, which makes perhaps Capella some easy pickings for another squad.
This segment brought to you by Fogo de Chão. Savor authentic Brazilian steakhouse flavors at Fogo de Chão, even on a busy schedule during weekday lunch. Visit their location in Chicago, Rosemont, and Naperville for lunch, starting at $15.
That's it?
That's it. Yeah, that's
all right.
I will need a nap.
Well,
with my fabulous experience at Fogo de Chão, I will need the.
There's nothing like going from meat sweats to nap. That's just a really good. That's a good transition. It's about an hour and a half of span of time. You know, you finish your meal, you get the meat sweats, you make it home, you put yourself down for about 45 minutes.
I call that a little afternoon. A Saturday.
You do the big lunches on Saturday.
Yeah, it can depend on the schedule, but more often than not, there's one extremely large meal and then two disproportionately small meals, and the large one induces a nap.
All of the large meals Rick has are also served on a sword, just like at Fogo de Chão.
He has his own sword.
Food on a sword. Yes. A serving sword.
I think food on a sword makes it taste better inherently.
Sweetheart, put that lunch meat on a saber and let's have a sandwich.
I did something I've never done last night because I was getting the one thing about growing your own herbs.
Is that a euphemism at all?
No. I'm growing this year. I've got
basil?
Chives, basil, and Italian parsley. And because of the recent weather, the basil's had its first explosion. And you make sure you remove the little flowers. If you don't remove the flowers, the leaves don't grow. So you have to pick off all the little white flowers.
Really?
Yes. You have to deadhead the basil, otherwise the leaves don't grow.
Huh.
And I've been doing that. And I looked at it. And I was like, oh my God, look at all that basil. And I didn't want to get trapped in the thing where at the end of the summer, I'm doing nothing but spending a day making pesto, which my daughter and I did. So I figured I'm having bruschetta for dinner.
Really?
Yup. So I bought this giant Italian bread, and I cut off these huge planks of giant slices of Italian bread,
right,
and oiled them and toasted them up, and I made this massive bowl. I got a half a pound of fresh mozzarella, and I picked half the basil, really good tomatoes and good oil, a little bit of red wine vinegar. Then I got the prosciutto, and I laid super thin, really fatty prosciutto out over the toast before I put the bruschetta topping on.
Melts just a little bit. Yeah, get you a little warm.
It just
kind of
soaks in there. Yeah. Right. And that was dinner. That was I don't know how much. I had to eat a lot of it.
It sounds great. It's just there's no sword in that story.
I know.
How do you eat? You
thought it was like a 40-year-old virgin thing where it's like, I did this and I got all this. Then cool. By the time
didn't
it was done,
it.
I just
really
wasn't
want
wanted anymore.
No, I
ordered Thai food instead. I just didn't really feel like it.
But it's the pressure. Mulligan's talking about having the smoker. When you start seeing these herbs, you're like, I don't want to waste these. Tonight, what can I make that calls for a ton of Italian parsley? Because I feel like it needs to be culled. I need to work, and you can't freeze. I don't want to give it away. I don't know what to do.
We'll do some Google work during the break. Oh. Italian parsley and you. That's what I'll search and figure out exactly how we... Italian parsley soared dinner recipes.
Because I could do a pesto that's parsley-based also and then spread that on something to do. But I don't know. And it's making me crazy. And I get home and it keeps growing.
Not really a pesto guy.
Really?
Yeah, not really a pesto guy. No, not well. I mean, I've had a few different kinds of pesto, but it just something in pesto tastes like soap to me, and it weirds me out.
It's funny because that's usually a cilantro issue.
I know, and I love cilantro.
And cilantro does not taste like soap to you?
It does not taste like soap to me.
Because that's a genetic thing.
Soap tastes like cilantro to me, which is
oddly enough
probably an issue. I mean, I'm in the shower with my Irish Spring, and I'm eating like, this cilantro rice is really good in the shower. But I, for whatever reason, pesto does not do it for me.
Okay.
Tastes like soap.
You haven't had – I do a special one with garlic, hot pepper, and anchovy.
Bring them in.
I'll bring it at the end of the year when I make all the pestos to use all the basil. I'll bring them all in.
When invariably let all of these herbs go to the end of the summer, you just make it all
and
anyway.
Then I get frightened and I don't know what to do.
All right.
So we have baseball talk coming up with Matthew Trueblood in just a little bit, and a lot of baseball odds and ends to get to. We got another Lucas Giolito start tonight. We have the White Sox beating Chris Sale 1-0.
We got to talk about Dylan Covey and Carlos Rodon.
Yeah.
There's a conversation to be had about those two young men.
Okay. Maybe we'll have it. That's what we do. We talk sports. Bernstein and McKnight on the score.
She nails every line in that show. Every single line. Jessica Walter, Lucille Bluth, Arrested Development, never misses.
Well, because if she misses, doesn't Jeffrey Tambor come over and beat her?
Yeah, I mean, that's an issue. Yep, that's okay. A problem. Tambor got a little aggressive with some of the comments toward her. And all the guys on that show are just jerks in that New York Times interview, too, about it.
That didn't go well.
Just
when
jerks.
You have a damage control interview and then you don't even know why you're there and what you're how you're supposed to
actively
be reacting to
actively dismissing her while she's there in the interview. Ali Shawkat, too. She brought it up and they just, terrible. I mean,
his glasses.
Stupid.
They make him look like a lizard. Plus, he's self-conscious.
Gee, I wonder why.
The best joke in that whole show comes in like the first 5 minutes of the pilot episode where she goes, I love all of my children equally. And then it's, I don't care for Job. She hits it. She just sticks it. God, she's hilarious.
This segment is brought to you by Fogo de Chão. Savor authentic Brazilian steakhouse flavors at Fogo de Chão. Even on a busy schedule during weekday lunch, visit their location in Chicago, Rosemont, and Naperville for lunch, starting at just $15. And a texter is saying, Bernstein, your answer's right in front of you on your parsley chimichurri sauce.
Chimichurri sauce.
Yeah, which is not Brazilian. It's actually Argentine. But, yeah, that's a great idea. That's a great idea. It's super easy.
It's like the green kind of oily sauce you put over a steak kind of thing?
Yep. It's parsley, oil, garlic, a little bit of red wine vinegar.
I've had this.
And some red pepper flakes on a freshly grilled piece of meat.
Tango sour.
Ideal
on Argentinian steak place.
On a skirt steak, beef heart, if you like. If you ever eat beef heart, Captain Beef Heart, it is it's a Peruvian dish usually. But for me, the beefier the meat, if it's like a flat iron steak, a flank, a skirt, anything coming from the plate, the really beefy cuts really take to a chimichurri. That's a good idea.
Are you more likely to grab the meat sweats on a beefier cut like that?
That's a good question.
Last time I had, I love it. Made the trip, had the meat sweats, and they got me. They got me.
Really?
Like I was victim to the meat sweats.
Done for the evening?
I rallied. It was a bachelor party. It was the first dinner of. It was the first thing we did. We're sitting down for dinner, and I got after it. Had a not really terrible, a glass or two of wine, but the meat sweats, they got me. And
the
there
South
I am in the
Americans,
back alley.
Again,
getting,
the South Americans have a way of doing this where there's a combination of either papaya. I want to say there
papaya.
Is an
papaya.
Yes, there's an enzyme. They finish the meal with a papaya-based dessert.
No, I finished the meal with more wine.
Because there's something – well, you can – there's liqueurs that are part of this too, but there actually is a system. Because if you look at – there's a tenderizer called papain, P-A-P-A-I-N, which is for corned beef and cheaper cuts of meat. And some of these like lower-scale steakhouses that operate in high volume, they use a papaya extract to tenderize – cheaper cuts of meat.
Huh.
And there is something naturally occurring in papaya that helps you digest meat. I'm not making
all of a sudden, you know, felt all right. I went just like this.
No, that was crab legs.
Yep.
That's different. That's crab legs.
I've been there.
I think I'm right about this, but I've heard about it before that somebody says that if you have, if there's an after dinner drink, the papaya dessert, and then some kind of after dinner cocktail, a digestif. I don't want to piss off Dust.
No, a digestif, yeah. Not an aperitif. Yeah, no, two different things. Yeah. Both ending in teeth.
Right, right. I don't want to make anybody too nervous around here. Give them the willies over the big culinary words.
Teeth, but, the plural of tooth. Yeah. That's just think of it that way if it helps you.
There's something. And again, 773. Just like Russian, drink vodka, bite pickle, eat potato. Okay, if that's your system, more power to you on that too. Now, Matthew Trueblood is a writer at Baseball Prospectus who had a piece that he wrote a couple years ago that came right back into context thanks to Joe Sheehan and his approach looking at the lack of defensive shifting by the Chicago Cubs simply because their pitchers just don't want it for reasons they can't really explain.
It's also back into context thanks to the, you know, commissioner of Major League Baseball in his conversation with a couple of different writers, Ken Rosenthal among them, about what baseball needs and doesn't need to quicken its pace of play. So now we get into whether the shift is actually doing the things we think it does.
I also, my question for Matthew, based on his research and what we're going to listen again to Joe Maddon, we're going to listen again to Theo Epstein, and then we're going to kind of ask who's right. I think Matthew Trueblood is going to maybe be the judge here in what's the best way to, what gets you closer to winning a World Series? Letting the pitchers be comfortable? Which is, it's a reasonable question.
Absolutely reasonable.
Or telling the pitchers, get over it. We know better where to put the defense than you do. Throw strikes, do what you're supposed to do, forget what's behind you, ignore it, pitch over it.
That conversation's next. It's Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
Even with the Rays, when we made it kind of in vogue to shift, if the pitcher did not want that guy there, he had the right to turn around and move him. Go ahead and move them or talk about it before the game, which is even better. I really don't like when after the fact something is said because all this is prepared beforehand. So the pitcher, he always has the right to throw the pitch he wants to. He can shake off the catcher anytime. And defensively, he can maneuver these guys any way he likes based on how he feels and what he's seeing on that particular day.
The pitcher's mindset absolutely is important. That said, there's so much evidence that comes into play with how we set up our infielders and outfielders, not just on the batter, but also factor in our pitcher and his tendencies and our game plan, how we're going to attack him. That's, let's all get on the same page here, and it's not going to work out every single time, but given the way we prepare and the way our guys work together and how good they are, it's going to help us. And when they see guys like Kyle Hendricks and Don Lester who've been here for a while buying in, I think it helps the new guys buy in too. And as long as you have the conversation ahead of time, you're transparent and come at it from a healthy place, it tends to work out.
If you listen closely to the Bernstein and McKnight show, you heard some inherent conflict there, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just two sides of a discussion they're being had regarding the shift and pitcher psychology on which side to err. On the one hand, on Wednesday, you heard Joe Maddon say, hey, pitchers, comfort is everything. The very next day, on this very show, you heard Theo Epstein say, yeah, we do this for a reason, and the data's overwhelming, and let's get with the program.
By the way, we're hoping John Lester and Kyle Hendricks convince anybody who comes over that this shift is good.
That was Theo Epstein pretty strongly. And if you speak Theo, you know the point that he was trying to make. So somebody who has studied this and is always aware of this push-pull on this continuum is Matthew Trueblood of Baseball Prospectus, who's on Twitter at M.A. Trueblood. So, Matt, thanks for joining us. And I guess the short question is, who's right, Maddon or Epstein?
Thank you, guys. And both of them are extremely right. There is data that supports these strategies, but Theo is making that point and saying, you know, we want to pursue optimization of our defensive alignment. But at the same time, Madden's right that a lot of the shift is mental. And for hitters, the effect that it has on hitters and the effect that it has on pitchers, it's not just about this guy standing here so he's got a better chance to get to this particular batted ball. It's about what batted balls are created or destroyed by the mental change that comes with realigning your defense. So that has to be constantly balanced. I think the Cubs are one of the best teams in the league at doing this. So even if you've got manager and GM saying different things, they seem to be arriving at a happy medium almost all the time.
Matt, I know the mental game of this, especially with the shift on, is an interesting part. And I know as we kind of looked into, the smarter guys at over at BP, looked into the shift and what it does and what it doesn't do, perhaps creating more walks, whether that's something that's attacking the comfortability of a pitcher. What about the idea, and maybe it's been proven, maybe it's been looked into, what about the idea that if a pull-heavy hitter is up there with the shift on, he knows just as much as the pitcher does that if he's swinging into a shift, he's less likely to get a hit. Isn't there more of a propensity for a hitter to perhaps be more patient and draw more walks to begin with?
I think there absolutely is. And that's it also, you know, in certain ways, an effective shift will also increase strikeouts because a batter feels like if he is going to swing and put the ball in play, it has to be at a certain speed. So he has to swing a little harder or with a little more lift. These things that create more swings and misses, too. So, yeah, it's definitely about the mental change that it affects in a hitter. But Russell Carlson, who did the research you're referring to, he corrected for that as well. And more to the point, I think those hitters that you would tend to shift are also hitters who would tend to be patient anyway. And so it's sort of hard to tease those two things out of each other. But, yeah, part of the increase in walks from the shift being on is going to be about the hitter needing to be more selective in order to create a successful batted ball. Another part of it is definitely about the pitcher feeling less comfortable, maybe attacking both sides of the plate or using certain pitches in certain counts.
It just seems to me, as you concluded years ago, that the Cubs, and at least Joe Madden has made his decision that a happy, comfortable pitcher is getting you closer to winning a World Series than trying to shave the out likelihood from, you know, around the margins, or shave away hit likelihood from the margins based on positioning. And I understand that when you are the manager and you are dealing with these people more often than dealing with numbers and results, I can see that. I'm trying to imagine the conversation. If we had Theo thinking one thing and Madden thinking the other, I don't know that we have a practical example of this, but what's the right way to have the conversation to make both things work, to make pitchers comfortable, but also have them comfortable in not worrying about where the defense is behind them?
Well, I think some of it is going to involve the numbers and being able to say, you know, maybe we will not be able to stop a couple of really hard hit balls from going for hits, but by having, you know, the feel the wind a little more naturally, those soft hit balls, those kind of accidental contacts, which are what a pitcher and the catcher are pursuing most of the time anyway, those are going to turn into outs more reliably if you have the defense sort of evenly spread across the field. What the exact conversation between manager and general manager is going to look like maybe doesn't have to matter all that much, because it's not just those two guys in the room. And a lot of the time it's going to be someone under Theo in the Cubs baseball operations department talking to someone more like Mike Borzello, mm-hmm. or whoever might be in charge of aligning the defense, developing the pitching game plan for a given series. Those guys are going to be the ones who work together and say, how do we balance the comfort of the guy on the mound and behind the plate with getting defenders close to the balls as they're hit?
Is it somewhat surprising to you that, considering the Cubs and Theo Epstein's front office and putting together the Cubs Way book, which presumably would begin to teach pitchers at a young level or a lower level that the shift is good and you want this on, that still, even though they've graduated some players from that minor league system into the majors, still the Cubs are toward the bottom tier in number of shifts put on, that seemingly that kind of, preach work hasn't really settled into some of the guys they've brought up?
You know, it's interesting. For one thing, the Cubs don't have an overwhelming number of homegrown arms in their rotation or even in their bullpen right now. So they, you know, whatever amount of training that into guys early that they've done hasn't gotten a chance to pay off in full. But I do think another part of it is this is a team that is built around extremely talented and athletic young position players. So when they have this kind of dilemma, this pull in both directions, they don't have to sort of succumb to the data as often. They can go with comfort and know that they still have one of the three or four best shortstops in baseball in terms of range in Addison Russell, who's going to turn balls that might be outs, you know, in the hole between third and short, turn some hits into outs there, whether he's shifted or not. So things like that make their job a little bit easier.
I guess that would be my question for Jake Arrieta or somebody else. It would be obviously more appropriate to ask the pitcher, why are you uncomfortable? What makes you uncomfortable? If the trust level is there, that the team is doing what it thinks it can do to turn a batted ball into an out, do you think a pitcher over remembers or takes to heart the couple times they induced weak contact and saw it dribble into a vacated area or land somewhere where there wasn't somebody? Do you think those just have sort of outsized place in somebody's memory?
Yeah, that's outlier bias, and we're all susceptible to it. And I think professional athletes can be especially so at times. And I do think that's a big part of it. The people we should really talk to find out how you work around that are the Houston Astros. Another one of my colleagues, our editor-in-chief at Prospectus, Aaron Gleeman, wrote an article recently about how the Astros are still leading the league in shift, but they are also throwing more strikes with the shift on than with it off. So they've successfully communicated to this whole crew of pitchers, some homegrown, some not, some soft throwers, some hard throwers, that you just trust your catcher, trust your game plan, trust your stuff. Don't worry about where our people are. They're going to get to the ball. And those guys are pounding the strike zone. They're turning a whole lot of batted balls into outs because they have shifts on. So there is a team out there getting that kind of buy-in. But, you know, the Cubs are also even better than the Astros at turning batted balls into outs. So whether it's a different kind of secret sauce or just that mental edge that comes from comfort and having Addison Russell and Javi Baez and Jason Hayward playing on the same team, it's working out for both teams, just in different ways.
So all this chatter about the defense and how we're setting guys on the field, and it sounds like perhaps that might not even matter come a season or two. Rob Manfred has talked about perhaps banning a shift or changing defenses around or perhaps drawing a circle on the field and telling defenders you have to stay there. Does any of that fix the problem baseball is trying to fix here?
It depends somewhat on what exactly Manfred's hoping to fix by doing that. If he's trying to create more balls in play by banning the shift, I'm not sure that it's going to have a meaningful impact. And I think there are better ways that they could do that that might not feel quite as peculiarly legislated. But it would have an impact. I mean, we just talked about the shift creates more walks. It probably creates more strikeouts. It certainly encourages more of that all or nothing kind of thought process at the plate. So it could have an impact. At what price? And, you know, are you legislating against innovation when really, as we're hearing from Russell now and seeing from teams like the Phillies, maybe the shift is going to kind of ebb back anyway. I'm not sure that there's a whole lot of reason for that kind of a measure.
We really appreciate your time, Matthew, and look forward to having some future baseball conversations with you as the season rolls on.
Thanks, guys.
That is Matthew Trueblood of Baseball Prospectus, the guy who's really been at the center of analyzing what teams are doing or are not doing as they move their defenses around.
These are the guys you ought to be paying attention to as baseball and Rob Manfred specifically starts to think about ways this game, they'd want to change this game, actually trying to manipulate the symptoms to make the game look like they want it to look for TV viewers, for those in the ballpark, for those consuming on random devices. I mean, that's forefront of the mind of Rob Manfred. It really is.
We are going to hit the midway next. We have a follow-up to our conversation with Dana White about a local UFC fighter who may not be long for the sport. We had an odd collision in the Rays game, the likes of which
you have to
see to believe.
No.
And a former White Sox pitcher starting a brawl in an independent league.
Oh, I know exactly who that's got to be.
if it were, if you had to put a list together of
one name
of pitchers voted most likely to start a brawl.
One name.
Okay, there's one name. On,
one name.
And you would have some inside knowledge there that I think we're going
one
to know about.
One damn name. I've got a story about cricket where we will not learn anything about cricket.
Wait, you're not allowed.
I swear to God, we will not learn anything about cricket
your whole
in this
point
conversation
of your earthly
about cricket.
Existence is
nothing
to avoid learning
about
cricket.
This will teach you anything about cricket. Okay. I promise.
Okay.
We also have a name coming into the collegiate ranks that is one an all-time name.
That's next, the Midday Midway on The Score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.